Before we begin today's episode, I'd like to put in a trigger warning. This is a very emotional episode that deals with abuse, rape, grooming, forced adoption, loss of children, and many other horrific things. If any of these things are something you would rather not listen to, we completely understand, and you should just skip this week's episode.
You're listening to the Pithy Chronicle, history with a bite.
I'm Caroline.
And I'm Erica. And we bring you history's dirtiest deeds, dripping with sarcasm.
Are you hungry yet?
Welcome back, Pithy listeners. Last week, we talked about the Ooku, Japan's secretive harem of the shogunate era. And this week we are traveling back in time to before the shogunate era of Japan, when the emperor was the emperor and actually had some power beyond divinity. And we are going to take a peek behind the beautifully ornate screens of the imperial court to catch a glimpse of the divine world through the eyes of Lady Nijo, a Japanese noblewoman, diarist, poet, and concubine to Emperor Gofukuza.
But before we go too far into history, let's do some housekeeping. Remember, we are doing a giveaway.
Boop, boop.
I'm really excited about this. We have a lot of really cool new things coming to our merch store. And to celebrate that, along with the season 4 release in September, we are doing a giveaway. And how can you participate in this giveaway, you may ask?
I am.
Yeah, you can either become a patron or you can buy us a coffee on buyusacoffee.com/thepithychronicle. For every dollar you spend, you are entered in a random drawing. And then once we draw someone, we are going to send you a little package of merch.
Goodies.
Yeah.
Please continue to follow us on our social media accounts. Check out our TikTok. And definitely make sure to like and review. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
We've been trending in Finland. Now we're going for
the rest of the world.
Well, yeah.
We have trended in other places before. We were trending in Germany at one point and then randomly South Africa.
Okay.
And New Zealand.
Okay. So those are interesting places that we haven't covered enough. So we have to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
But today we're going back to the land of the rising sun. And we're talking about Lady Nijo. Born a member of the impressive Koga family, which is a branch of the Minamoto clan, descended from Emperor Murakami through his 7th son, Lady Nijo had an impressive lineage, if somewhat far removed from greatness. Her father and paternal grandfather held important court positions, and many of her relatives were lauded for their literary and intellectual abilities, including, centuries later, Lady Nijo herself.
We love to hear it.
Of course, like most of my episodes for some reason, Lady Nijo isn't her real name.
My gosh.
I know, it's always mine.
It really is.
Sadly, her given name doesn't survive. Instead, Nijo was her courtly name, and it's pretty much all we have to go on. Nijo literally means Second Avenue, because it was common practice within the court at the time to designate court ladies by street names.
What?
Yeah. They were like, oh, hey, Fifth Avenue.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's terrible.
I mean, Second Avenue is better than Fleet Street.
That's
there were other
true.
Choices.
That's true.
Second Avenue likely indicated her close proximity to the imperial household and the emperor himself. So at least Nijo meant that she had some importance to the emperor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that we've gotten over the name thing, let's talk about the icky stuff. How?
The icky stuff? I thought this was supposed to be the salacious, fabulous stuff.
Well,
you're giving me icky?
How do you think the young Nijo came to claim the attention of the emperor?
The way that I want to know.
You do. You want to know. It's not nice, though.
Okay.
The answer is through her mother.
Oh, gross.
And we can see this going many ways, but it's going to go in a weirder way than you anticipate.
No,
because
I don't.
Because Emperor Gofukuza was in love with Lady Nijo's mom. In fact, she was his concubine before her own marriage, and even more, it said that she was the one who introduced the then young emperor to the pleasures of sex.
Oh my god. She swiped the V card and then her daughter was his
chosen
lover? Oh god. Mm-hmm. No.
Lady Nijo's mother died soon after she gave birth to Lady Nijo, and from that day on, Emperor Gofukuza watched and waited until his first love's daughter was of age.
Dare I ask, what age is of age?
It's 14.
Oh no, that's an eighth grader. That's an eighth grader.
I hate it when you do that because historically 14 isn't terrible. But when you say eighth grader, it makes it nasty.
It is.
Yeah. Don't worry, it gets worse.
No.
Because Lady Nijo's father actually gave her to the emperor. He'd known this was coming the whole time. In her memoir, she describes the scene. Completely unaware of what is about to happen, she attends an informal imperial meal with her father and the emperor.
Because you just do that?
Her father works at the court, so she grew up within this lifestyle. And her mother is dead, and so part of that means she was raised in the court, whereas a lot of other young women her age would have been at home with the female parent.
Sure.
Completely unaware of what's about to happen, they sit down and have a meal, and the two men start speaking in innuendos. She's a bit confused because, as you pointed out, she's an eighth grader. And then her dad looks at her, winks, proverbially, says, "Have fun," and then leaves his daughter to the whim of a man more than twice her age who has been grooming her for this moment since mom died.
I really want to punch this man in the face. Mm-hmm. And I don't know which one I want to punch more, the emperor or the dad. Probably dad. Definitely.
Let's just wait and see where you fall on this issue. Because this is the real reason that I wanted to do this episode.
Okay.
The dad leaves. The emperor kind of spells it out for her. And she says, no.
Good for her.
Right?
Good for her.
She looks at him and is like, no, I don't think so, dude. Yep. That is,
Dear God, no.
No.
Because that's what he was.
Yeah.
He's a deity.
Gofukuza really hadn't expected this, because to his credit, he is the emperor, and he's, like, all confused. And so he pulls a Mr. Collins, a la Pride and Prejudice. He's like,
what excellent boiled potatoes.
I know that it is usual with young ladies to reject the addresses of the man whom they secretly mean to accept when he first applies for their favor. And she says, what? No, I'm an eighth grader. And then he goes on with his Mr. Collins act, and he says, sometimes the refusal is repeated a second or even a third time. I am therefore by no means discouraged by what you have just said.
No, please be discouraged.
And to that, I'm sure she gave a very Elizabeth Bennet-esque speech telling him to seriously be discouraged. However, at some point, the emperor's patience and probably amusement ran out.
I'm scared. What happens? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It was rape.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was not pretty.
No.
He basically went with this Mr. Collins act until she just was clearly not changing her mind.
And he just said, I'll change your mind for you.
I've been waiting for you since you were born. Here we go.
Oh, God.
And Dad is in the next room.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
No, sir.
While their first time together was not magical, probably for either one, because I'm sure he was expecting a different reaction. I don't think he wanted it to be that way. Not that that's an excuse, because he's clearly an abuser and a
gross man.
But I don't think that's what he anticipated, because he, I think, had a very sensual but consensual relationship with her mother. I don't know why it didn't occur to him that she'd find that gross, but she did, and he was surprised. It wasn't anything close to what he had with the mother. But it did continue. She came to court and became, well, actually, it rather depends on who you ask. So there is some debate about whether or not she was a wife or a concubine, because her memoirs, which is all we have to go off of, give a little bit of evidence of both.
But there are big differences between those.
It's not as much of a difference in Japanese culture between a concubine and a wife. It is a very different relationship from that of a mistress and a wife in the West. A concubine, and this is important, is not a mistress. Elizabeth Abbott in her book Mistresses says, quote, concubinage was the handmaiden of marriage, recognized by law and accepted by society. Cultures in which concubinage existed accepted the desire of men not to be constrained by monogamy, because that would just be too much for their poor little souls, and to accommodate their need to demonstrate their virility, wealth, and power through having many sexual partners alongside their wives.
God.
Yeah.
Men just really never change. They are just such a simple creature.
They are.
Still, wife, concubine,
it's different. It's very different, but mistresses in the West were clandestine relationships whose children were bastards, quote-unquote.
Sure.
Whereas concubines were legally recognized, they were acknowledged, and their offspring were almost always considered legitimate, as we heard last week with the concubine mother kind of ruling the roost. But that said, most scholars think that Lady Nijo was originally on the fast track to wife of the emperor.
Okay.
It didn't start off great. And she would never have been his first wife.
Right.
He was many times married at this point. She wouldn't have been his official consort, but being a wife is still a higher
right.
ranking position. However, just a year into their quote-unquote relationship, her father died. And her father had been this influential figure at court, but upon his death, she lost her only remaining male relative, and the only person who was looking out for her well-being except
the
emperor.
So not only is he her abuser, but also she's got nowhere else to go.
No money, no power, no home, nothing.
Okay.
Yeah, she's stuck with her abuser as her only financial hope. She had no other choice.
Yeah.
And while the emperor did take care of her, he no longer had any incentive to make her a wife. They both knew that she had no other means of survival, so why risk pissing off his official consorts when he could just keep her as a concubine as she was now? And so that's what happened. Things did almost turn around for her. The emperor was desperate for a son.
Shock. Oh,
history
shock.
Just keeps on repeating. And she gave birth to a son, and she was the first to do so. He'd had no luck with any of his wives or concubines previously. However, he died. The son died in infancy before his first birthday. And so for a moment, even though a concubine's child could be legitimate, had the son lived, there's a good chance that she would have been promoted to an official wife just because there's only one, you know, gotta really protect it.
Right, right, right.
But once he died, it was literally the final nail in her wifely coffin. And because of this young boy's death, she fell from the wifely path. And from that point on, we find a lot more evidence of her being treated like a concubine rather than a wife. For example, at times, she was forced to have sex with other men of the court against her will and at the request of the emperor. She was a gift.
I hate this.
Given to high-powered men who pleased the emperor.
This is terrible.
I'm so sorry. It's terrible. So she was the reward for men that did things well.
Uh-uh.
Also, he sometimes listened.
Gosh, this man is just a piece of slime.
Mm-hmm.
A trash.
Mm-hmm.
This is awful.
She also acted as a go-between between the emperor's new sexual conquests and the emperor himself.
Oh, so
that's
not
probably
a
not
wife.
Something he would have had a wife do.
No.
She did, however, take many lovers of her own.
Well, that's rather unlike a wife, and hopefully she found some happiness. Please tell me this woman had an ounce of happiness in her life.
I think she found love at times with many different men. She always referred to them by nicknames in her memoir. But we do know that one of them, at least, was the emperor's half-brother, whom she bore two children.
Okay.
And did not get to keep.
Of course not.
Some of her lovers were hidden from the emperor because, of course, he was her meal ticket. But some were more blatant. I think basically as she got older and as he enjoyed her company less, she had a little bit more freedom.
Yeah. Do not enjoy
she
my company.
She ended up bearing four children in total. The son to the emperor who died. And then three others, all of whom were whisked away after birth and given up for adoption. Because while it might be okay for the emperor to know something was going on, a visual reminder was not.
Not accepted.
Not accepted. From her memoir, quote, "I could not forget the face I had glimpsed but once. It would have been impossible for me to keep her, even if I so desired. There was nothing for me to do but wrap my sleeves around myself and sob inwardly."
God.
This is a bit of a Debbie Downer.
A bit.
I see that. So you can imagine her emotions. She's giving birth in secret. I mean, once she even had to pretend it was a miscarriage to keep the emperor from questioning the paternity. Gosh. She never held her own child except for the son that died. And it was all just in order to preserve a relationship with her rapist and sometimes pimp. Unsurprisingly, the young and sensitive Lady Nijo became very attached to her lovers, because as you said, they were that one glimmer of happiness, of freedom, of choice. And that frankly, awkwardly, weirdly, uncomfortably, often included Go Fukuza. Even if she despised him, he was the only man that she knew was taking care of her in one way or another, and she was still incredibly jealous when his attentions went to someone else.
I mean, it's almost like Stockholm Syndrome.
I had the same thought. But there was someone even more jealous at the court, which was Emperor Gofukuza's official consort. She didn't like Lady Nijo, probably because she knew her husband had been waiting for this woman since her birth, which is a very strange concept.
It is.
Perhaps she hated the connection with the emperor's first love because she kind of lived through that as well. Perhaps it was the birth of a son, however short-lived, that just ate her up inside. And maybe there's another slight that we don't know about, but she wanted to get rid of Lady Second Avenue. I'm First Ave, get out.
Get out.
Calling her self-obsessed and haughty, the empress had nothing nice to say about Lady Nijo. And I will say that some of those adjectives are pretty well-deserved because if you read through her diary, which is what the memoir really is, it's a diary. It's very personal. It's very emotion-filled. You do see that Lady Nijo is a bit self-superior. She criticized pretty much every other woman as less than herself. You know, they lacked character. They wore horrific fashions. They bored her to tears. She went on and on. But again, she was a teenager.
Yeah.
On her own, bearing the loss of not one but four children, with no protector but her abuser. One can hardly imagine she'd be happy about her lot in life, but once the Empress sets her sights on Lady Nijo, it was just a matter of time. Emperor Gofukuza originally tried to defend her because he did really care for her in his own weird way, but the proverb, happy wife, happy life, is reality. Listen up, guys. At some point, it was no longer worth his trouble.
Sure.
And that point came on a very drunken evening with his brother, Kaneyama. The emperor's brother, Kaneyama, came to visit. And it was not just any brother, it was his younger brother who had succeeded in pushing Gofukuza into early retirement. This was not unusual, especially for his specific imperial family. It was pretty common to retire early and give the next guy a chance, and then the next guy, and then the next guy. But it's still a pretty sore point to see your younger brother, who is now the emperor, and you are the retired emperor, come to your court and get drunk. And as they got drunker and drunker, eventually there were only three left standing, Kaneyama, Gofukuza, and Lady Nijo. And through his beer goggles, Kaneyama asked his older brother, can I just, like, have her for the night?
Is this not the brother that she's already had a relationship with?
Different one. This one's a full brother. The half-brother was the one she had children with.
Okay.
And Gofukuza had agreed to something like this in the past, but not to his pushy younger brother. No older sibling wants to share their toys with their annoying baby brother. This was not what he wanted. But unfortunately, before he could really protest too much, Gofukuza fell asleep in a drunken stupor and therefore couldn't ensure that nothing happened. So what was Lady Nijo to do? Now she is basically alone with the current emperor who wants her. She can't refuse, he is the emperor. And so she slept with him. And the next morning, Gofukuza learned of it because, jerk that he was, Kaneyama couldn't wait to shove it in his face. He came down to breakfast the next morning and was like, wow.
These are just awful people.
Yeah. The ex-emperor Gofukuza was furious, and I'm sure he felt betrayed. And this was compounded by another pregnancy soon after with a different lover, who then tragically died. So she's mourning the death of that lover, giving birth, giving that baby up for adoption. All the while, the actual ex-emperor Gofukuza is pissed off at her and she's away from court. And the empress decided that this was the moment to make her move, and to be fair, she was totally right. Out of sight, out of mind, Gofukuza's jealousy was off the charts, and Nijo's absence allowed her to be permanently expelled from court. Which, like, you think in one way, excellent, she's away from him.
Right.
But in another
that
way,
was my first thought.
What the heck is she gonna do?
Well, what did she do?
Well, at first she was pretty surprised. She was pretty shocked, actually. I don't think she thought this could happen. And then she was angry, and then she was scared, but eventually...
Yeah?
She's relieved. For the first time in her life, she is free. She had been raised from birth to be Gofukuza's concubine, and now she could finally figure out who she was at 26 years old.
26?
She's 26.
She's a child.
She's had four children. She's lost multiple lives. She's a child. Yeah. She took holy orders and became a Buddhist nun.
Fine.
Which was a pretty common practice for people retiring from the courtly life.
Buddha's not gonna rape her.
Nope. And she definitely took the road less traveled by, literally, going all across the country by herself with no servants to attend her. And that was shocking to the people that knew her. It was most improper. Independence was not exactly kosher for medieval Japanese women. But she really had no choice because she also had no money.
Mm-hmm.
To earn her meager living, she recited poetry and occasionally advised on interior decor.
Girls gotta work it.
Yep. Through this freedom, she also met people from a non-imperial social background for the very first time. And through speaking with them, she seemingly found compassion. And it's a transformation that you can hear in her memoirs. She goes from this catty teenager that's unimpressed with anyone or anything to a softer, more faithful, more sincere woman. Through her travels, she discovered that Buddhism linked all people, no matter their pedigree or wealth, and it really changed her. However, the Stockholm Syndrome still existed because she did miss Gofukuza. One historian referred to him as her lifelong spiritual companion, because even when she was free, she just couldn't stop thinking about him.
A spiritual companion? Like, this historian to have been a man.
They did meet a few times after she took holy orders. The first time was 8 years into her exile. He too at this point had taken holy vows, and coincidentally they were both visiting the same shrine at the same time.
Oh my gosh.
Quote, "It was His Majesty's voice, unchanged, speaking directly from the past. And to her he said, I have never forgotten you."
Okay, but has he never forgotten her or her mom?
It was a bittersweet meeting because he wanted to reminisce about the past and she wanted to focus on the future. However, the memoir does imply that they made love, and I think made love is a better term than sex in this instance. But it's clear that she was conflicted about it because she has the freedom to choose that now. And so I think she struggled to decide if she was using her freedom and making this choice, or if she was coerced, or if she just did it because that's what habit says to do. After this meeting, they did continue to write to each other for the rest of their lives, and occasionally they had secret rendezvous. It's clear that there is some attachment. What it is, if it's kosher, or if it's like mentally stable, is a different matter, but in 1304, Gofukuza died, and she seemed to mourn him deeply. It was a complicated relationship, but the two were forever linked, or at least she was forever linked to him. Even if she would have wished otherwise. Quote, "Even when it grew late, I could not bring myself to return home, summoning up memories of the distant past. I felt pangs of grief impossible for words to describe." After his death, she began working on this autobiography / memoir / diary. And from 1304 to 1307, she describes her formative years at court, the good, the bad, and the despicable. And it concludes with his death. It's thought that perhaps she too passed away soon after this. She would have been 49 years old when the autobiography ends. But it's just as likely that she lived on and devoted herself to her faith and to her freedom. We don't know. We don't know what her name was outside of Lady Nijo, and we don't know the end of her tale. In fact, we almost didn't even know about her. The memoir, which is entitled A Tale That No One Asked For.
God!
Can you believe it? Like, we call it The Life of Lady Nijo in English, but it's a tale that no one asked for. And it was similar to a diary. It was intensely personal, with teenage hormonal feelings running rampant. And the work does not paint Gofukuza in a very positive way, as you have noted. Through her words, it's clear that he is a man, nothing more. He is fallible, often cruel, and most definitely not divine. Which,
explosive. For the time.
Therefore, it was suppressed for nearly 8 centuries. It wasn't rediscovered until 1938, And even then, all we actually have is a copy that was made by a 17th century emperor who had rewritten it by hand. He had found it in the archives and I guess read it and rewrote it, and that's all we have. So we don't have the original either. It wasn't released to the public, however, until the mid-1960s, coming a little over a decade after Emperor Hirohito renounced his claim of divinity as one of the stipulations to end World War II. And only then, when Japan's emperors could no longer claim infallibility, Our Lady Nijo's words offered up to the world. It's impossible to know what's true and what's fiction. After all, we have no idea how many changes that 17th century emperor made. And we all know how hyperbolic a teenager's diary can be.
Yes.
But even with those unanswerable questions, Lady Nijo's tale is still enormously important to Japanese history and literature. It's rare to hear the female perspective. It's even more rare to hear the concubine's perspective. And like any good, juicy diary, she focuses on many of the taboo topics that are exciting for readers like us, but rather damaging to the subjects. Through her work, we experience trauma, sorrow, abuse, until her tides change and she finds freedom, redemption, triumph, and even rebirth.
Wow, that was a rod.
And with that, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Erica, and we are Pithily Yours.
This episode is brought to you by the Pithy Chronicle, LLC. The Pithy Chronicle is intended for education, entertainment, and non-commercial purposes. Any views or opinions expressed in this podcast are personal and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the owner may or may not be associated with in any professional or personal capacity. While we offer lots of sarcasm, this podcast does not offer any advice or services. Listening to this podcast may induce fits of laughter, unexpected distraction, or uncontrollable rage at the subjects, hopefully not at us. We hope you learned something today. If not, so sorry. Please be advised we are not experts in the following fields: medical, legal, financial, technological, thermonuclear engineering, submarine warfare, neuroscience, or cat husbandry. Thanks for listening to our little disclaimer. Just covering our history-loving asses. Bye!